From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This spring, we aired a series of stories about the internet. We explored what it's doing to our ability to concentrate and socialize. We asked whether we need a new internet altogether, a safer yet more restrictive web. And we considered the darker side of internet anonymity. This week, we're combining those pieces into a single show, starting with Bob's piece about how online anonymity creates a new class of victim and predator.
Through your Explorer toolbar, Microsoft knows your every keystroke. Your EasyPass and your GPS cell phone monitor your whereabouts and record them. Your financial details and health information are data files somewhere, most likely many somewheres. Your purchases are tracked at the supermarket checkout, and Google serves you online ads based on the content of your personal Gmail. It's downright creepy if you think about it. If Big Brother were interested in you personally, you'd have nowhere to hide.
We are one people, with one will, one resolve, one cause.
But on that point, I've got some good news for you. Big Brother isn't much interested in you personally. Every marketer in America is extremely interested in your IP address, which tells them what the consumer at your computer is likely to buy. But unless you get in the government's crosshairs, the chances of you, the actual person, being victimized by the powers that be are quite remote. But here's the bad news. In a connected world, there are 6 billion little brothers.
The Orwellian literary landscape imagines a universe that made sense at the time it was written, which is to say there is a concentrated amount of power in a central authority figure, and that central authority is the hub around which the rest of us are spokes.
Michael Furdick is founder of the Internet Privacy Service, Reputation Defender.
We now see that the world is one in which there are many, many hubs and many spokes.
Millions of blogs, websites, and comment boards provide millions of opportunities for someone to insult you, to float rumors about you, tell lies about you, reveal secrets about you, post compromising photos of you, and otherwise make your life a living hell. You have very little to fear from 1984, but every reason to quake about Lord of the Flies. Anyone who frequents sports websites, or politics, or classical music, for that matter, knows that the anonymity and physical distance of internet communication can lead otherwise civilized people to barbarism and cruelty. The online disinhibition effect, it's called.
So some research we did out of my lab found that when people are communicating online, they tend to become more focused on themselves, which means they're more focused on their attitudes and emotions.
Adam Joynton is a professor of psychology at England's University of Bath.
And if you combine that with a lack of concern about the person you're talking to, not being aware of their reaction and their response, then quite often you can get a powder keg where people do tend to vent, they do tend to flame.
The rage manifests itself in various ways and creates various categories of victims. Websites such as dumponyou.com and Revenge World exist for the very purpose of character assassination. Many celebrity websites are e-tabloids, hungering to embarrass the rich and famous.
I don't give a damn that you're 12 years old or 11 years old, or that you're a child, or that your mother is a thoughtless pain in the ass. You have humiliated me for the last time with this phone.
When Alec Baldwin's angry voicemail to his daughter showed up online, the actor was excoriated. When skanky pictures of American Idol contestant Antonella Barba appeared, she was briefly the most Googled woman in the world. But nothing to do with her singing. They, of course, sought the spotlight only to get more than they bargained for. Not so Ghislain Raza, the chubby teenager known worldwide as the Star Wars kid. He was victimized by classmates who came upon a videotape of his Darth Maul lightsaber routine and, without his permission, posted it online. Because of Ghislain's unheroic appearance and because his lightsaber was actually a telescoping golf ball retriever, he's been laughed at more than a billion times worldwide, making him the most ridiculed of all ridiculed fat kids in human history. And then there was Meghan Meyer. She was a 13-year-old Missouri girl who made a fast friend on MySpace only to have that sweet, cute 16-year-old Josh turn on her, ridicule her, tell her the world would be better without her. Only after Megan committed suicide was it revealed that Josh was an invented character created by two adults to intentionally crush her. Yes, for all its revolutionary benefits, the internet is also a malice engine. The men's room wall writ unimaginably large, but with one devastating difference. You can scrub the bathroom wall. Google just crawls the web and brings back what it finds from wherever and whenever. Search for someone who has been defamed ever and up the slander pops, because a search engine can't distinguish between truth and falsity, much less malice and goodwill.
Google just passed 1 trillion websites it indexes with its search engine.
Mark Lemley is a professor of law at Stanford University.
To create a legal regime under which Google had an obligation to check all of the content on those 1 trillion websites and have a lawyer determine whether it might defame somebody would essentially mean that you couldn't have a search engine.
Lemley gets that, but he also represents 2 former Yale law students, Britton Heller and Heidi Iravani, who were repeatedly viciously targeted by anonymous online critics on a law school admissions discussion board called AutoAdmit.com. The women were falsely accused of everything from sexual impropriety to heroin addiction to cheating, and were subject to lascivious speculation of the most graphic and sometimes violent kind by dozens of unknown attackers. David Margalik wrote about the case in this month's Portfolio magazine.
In Britton Heller's case, somebody who knew her as an undergraduate posted something anonymously saying, "Hey, Yaleys, Britton Heller is going to be in your entering class. Watch out for her." Heidi Iravani got involved because one of her classmates posted a picture of her and started commenting on her breast size. And then everybody starts jumping and pouncing in and contributing to the degeneration. It became a kind of cyber free-for-all.
With consequences beyond humiliation. Heller says she was turned down by the first 16 law firms she approached for job interviews because, she was certain, Google searches returned results from AutoAdmit besmirching her every which way. And here's where it gets ironic. 2 law students victimized on a website for law students found themselves stymied by the law. Heller asked AutoAdmit to remove the offensive postings, but the proprietors refused, citing the First Amendment. The women asked Google to take down the defamatory posts from its search results, but Google also refused, citing federal law. Under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, web entities cannot be held responsible for defamation or libel perpetrated by users, lawyer Mark Lemley.
That immunity provision doesn't have a counterpart in the physical world. It was created, I think, because of one of the significant differences between the internet and the physical world, which is the sheer volume of information that can be posted on these electronic equivalents of bulletin boards.
Thus, Congress granted blanket immunity to everyone but the author of libelous or defamatory content. If you've been slimed online and you want justice, you've got to take it up with the slimer. Heller and Iravani attempted just that by filing John Doe lawsuits and subpoenaing AutoAdmit for the identities of their harassers. But under the protection of Section 230, David Margalik explains, AutoAdmit had scrubbed its servers of the data that could connect IP addresses to those posts.
So the women could identify a grand total of only 5 or 6 of them, and most of them they identified because they, at one time or another, gave away information that identified who they were.
So does the Communications Decency Act need a do-over? It was passed, after all, in 1996, while the internet was in its infancy. Privacy hawks say no. Kurt Upsall is senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
We, as a society, have taken a bet that it would be better to have a lot of different voices rather than have the law or the courts decide which voices can come forward.
For one thing, he says, this country has always had rude ad hominem speech, clear back to the founders. Furthermore, he says, as some courts have ruled, readers know how to look at salacious material in context. DumpOnYou.com isn't exactly the congressional record.
in a lot of these sites, it's hard to find them very credible. You know, if you see somebody say that so-and-so is a criminal on a site that is filled with hyperbole and bile, how much credence should you really give it? Not much.
But Google reports results entirely out of context. Ask Britton Heller, who sued her tormentors, hired Reputation Defender, and still must live with a Google results page that has, as item number 5, is Britton Heller a lying bitch? To Michael Furtick, this screams for a revision in the law, one that would give targets of character assassination at least as much protection as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act confers upon intellectual property owners. Under that law, a website is under no liability if it takes down copyrighted content at the written request of the copyright holder.
Now, under this comparative set of regimes, NBC can send one letter to YouTube and force it to remove 50,000 videos, as happened.
But if someone photoshops you into Nazi regalia or worse, then posts it all over the internet with your name and address attached, well, that's just hard cheese. Yes, under current law, a Saturday Night Live skit is afforded more protection than you are. Still, Upsol of the Electronic Frontier Foundation worries that giving privacy the same status as copyright would encourage anybody whose feelings get bruised, especially government officials, to inundate websites with demands to take down unflattering material, even truthful unflattering material. But Furtick says that's silly.
We could require, for example, that anyone who believes himself or herself to be defamed to file an affidavit saying that, to the best of my knowledge, this is totally false, and to be penalized under penalty of perjury if his or her own claim filed in front of a clerk of the court turns out to be false. It's not like the alternative to the status quo is totalitarianism. It's not true. It's false. It's wrong. There are 100 steps between where we are today and a scenario in which we really chill speech. So I suggest we take 3 steps down that primrose path, not 100.
Or else, never mind what Andy Warhol said, in the future, everyone will be defamed in perpetuity.
Coming up, is the internet rotting our brains?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi, Jesse Thorne here, host and producer of The Sound of Young America. Our show's been such a successful podcast that some people don't know that it's also a nationally syndicated public radio show. As such, I'm obligated to ask deep, probing questions, even of young, starry-eyed comedians like John Mulaney.
Should we fight?
Huh?
I think we should fight.
Should we break a broomstick in half and just go at it?
Just go to town.
Yeah, I could never fight you, though, because you are a fellow sufferer of babyface old radio voice.
Yeah.
Which we're both afflicted with.
Check out The Sound of Young America and a whole bunch of other podcasts at MaximumFun.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, with the next piece from our internet series, which first aired this spring. This year on the British program Newsnight, the famously relentless host Jeremy Paxman tackled the issue that is eating away at good parents everywhere.
Got a child who uses a social networking site like Facebook or Twitter or something? Who hasn't, you might say? Well, their brain's being rotted, or at least that's more or less what the Daily Mail claimed this morning. The paper was citing Baroness Susan Greenfield, who told us today that repeated exposure to screens could rewire the brain.
It follows if the human brain is so impressionable, if the environment is changing, then the brain might change too. There is no
The Baroness, a neuroscientist at the University of Oxford, willingly conceded that the problem, in the absence of any actual proof, was still theoretical, but then caused a ruckus by just as willingly speculating on the psychological damage posed by long hours spent online.
A shorter attention span, an emphasis on process, on the experience of the moment, rather than content, of an identity that needs to be bolstered up with Twitter, and perhaps an increased recklessness.
Greenfield says the internet is stunting our social development. A report in the British magazine Biologist claims it's making us lonely. An article in last summer's Atlantic asks, is Google making us stupid? So what is the internet doing to our brains? Inquiring minds want to know. 2 years ago, writer John Lawrence suggested in the Canadian magazine The Walrus that the internet is probably making our minds more inquiring, and not in a good way.
I came across some studies that had identified these two terrifically descriptive terms, informivores and information foraging, when you're working online. There is this craving for information. It's difficult to know when to stop. And you can go on link by link by link ad infinitum.
Down the rabbit hole.
Down the rabbit hole. You're always waiting to get closest to some ideal of a perfect state of information. And, you know, in a pre-digital, pre-internet environment, you could get to that place fairly quickly. Whereas with the internet, I do think that the horizon is much further off, and yet you still crave that. And I do think that's the addictive nature of it.
The byproduct of information addiction is chronic distraction. And though there is as yet no hard data on the impact of the internet, there is a vast body of work devoted to the consequences of constant interruption. Most of that research predates the internet, and yet interruption defines our digital lives. We continually break away from one task to attend to another. An email, an instant message, a pop-up, a purchase, a quick detour offered by an intriguing link. We call it multitasking.
We don't actually multitask. We serial task.
Frank Russo, director of the Science of Music Auditory Research and Technology Lab at Ryerson University, says that if we could do two tasks at once, we wouldn't crash the car while talking on the phone. What we really do is flip back and forth, constantly breaking our mental flow.
So we might be entertaining a thought, and we might be trying to think about, well, how does this fit with other things I know? How can I advance what I'm looking at and get to the next step? All of that hard cognitive work is taken away once we get that pop-up message. So if we're doing something that involves some sort of complicated thought, developing an argument of any kind, it's not going to be as efficient if we have constant disruptions.
So does that mean that Google is making us stupid?
We've been getting more intelligent as assessed by standard intelligence tests progressively over the last 50 years. So that's the part I don't get, I have to say. Somehow we're getting more intelligent, but it's also clear to me, just anecdotally from my own experience, that people seem to have less tolerance for complex arguments. I don't know how those things add up.
At UCLA, we recently did a study that we affectionately termed Your Brain on Google.
Gary Small, director of the Memory and Aging Center at UCLA and author of iBrain, Surviving the Technological Alteration of the Modern Mind.
And what we did was to look at the brain in real time when it searches online. And we found that older people who had prior internet experience showed a much greater degree of brain activity than those who were naive to the internet search experience. So the headline became, Google is making us smart. And I don't think it's that simple. I think in some ways, Google may be making us stupid because we spend not as much time thinking about issues in depth.
Less depth, more breadth. There are trade-offs with every new technology. Socrates complained that writing things down was bad for the memory. We hear that same complaint about digital technology. We can't remember phone numbers because they're stored in our cell phones. Boo-hoo. There is a limit to how much we can hold in our brains, isn't there?
You think?
No, seriously. I mean, several have said that, you know, brain functions like a computer. You have RAM. I think back on the things that are in my mind taking up space that I wish I could get rid of, like the theme song to the Patty Duke show.
Meet Kathy, who lived most everywhere.
I don't really need that anymore.
That's haunting you too. My God, what a coincidence. Now that you've said it, I'm going to be thinking of that the rest of the afternoon.
But as a result, that's a little bit of space that maybe I could have devoted to something useful, but I can't delete that memory. As somebody who knows so much about memory, the fact that you can offload some of these unnecessary bits of flotsam is a good thing. It expands our capacity, right?
That's right. And we don't need to remember a lot of these details. We need to know how to get the details.
But we can't offload social skills like we can phone numbers. What about the concern that constantly connecting through online social networks is rendering us less capable of connecting in real life? A recent British study found that the number of people saying that there is no one with whom they can discuss important matters nearly tripled in the last two decades. Lee Rainey directs the Pew Internet and American Life Project.
In the data that we gather in our research, we don't see a lot of increased levels of loneliness, increased levels of isolation.
Rainey's project offers periodic updates on the future of the internet.
We see that people use the internet and use their cell phones in an additive way. They add to the number of people that they interact with in the world, and they don't use those devices as substitutes for other kinds of human contact that are enriching and helping people's lives. There are lonely people in the world. There are people who are inclined to withdraw from the world, and the availability of these technologies does help them stay isolated. But for the vast majority of people that we talk to and we look at in our research, they say these technologies are adding to their social well-being and adding to the richness of their social lives.
Psychiatrist Gary Small, who wrote the book iBrain, is among many experts who expect that someday holograms will be able to replicate the experience of meeting face-to-face. It's also increasingly likely that the technology will give us a chance at a kind of intimacy we may never have thought possible, the ability to meet mind to mind.
We have a little illustration in iBrain where there are people wearing these little headband sensors where they can communicate with their handheld devices or laptops just by merely thinking about it. And those thoughts are wirelessly transmitted to their computer. So they can say to each other just with their thoughts, let's meet at Starbucks, and not even have to talk.
So the technology of the internet will continue to redefine our personal relationships. But what about relationships on a societal scale between political and religious groups, ethnicities, and nations? Lee Rainey says that all the experts consulted by Pew agree that in a few years, mobile devices will allow us to stay continuously connected to the internet. But they're split 50-50 on whether that's for the good. The optimists say
that the more we learn, the more we interact, the more that we discover about the world, it improves our lives and it improves the general social condition. We just get to know each other better and good things happen because of that.
The pessimists say
that our propensity to be nasty or propensity to shun those who are not in our in-group or the propensity for people to find just information that agrees with their worldview, all of that will be amplified in this new world. And so we will become more isolated, more hard-edged in our beliefs. And it will be a state of nature more than it will be nirvana.
A worry that's long plagued media watchers, like me, is the echo chamber phenomenon, in which like-minded people huddle in bubbles in the blogosphere where they never have to confront a conflicting opinion or unwelcome fact, where in defense of the dogma of the tribe, moderates are sidelined and extremists exalted. Rainey conducted a study of people's politics and the internet during the 2004 presidential campaign. He found that the echo chamber phenomenon is a byproduct of human nature, not the internet. The net merely amplifies what's worst and best in us all.
One of the surprising things we found in that survey was that those who are the most technologically adept and those who are the most engaged with information actually are not in the echo chamber pattern. They are actually seeking out and finding out more arguments opposed to their views than those who are less technologically adept and less interested in political information.
Wait a minute. You have just blown my mind. So what you're saying is that regardless of their political persuasion, the more comfortable they were in cyberspace, the more likely they were to know views across the spectrum and views other than their own.
Right. They essentially behaved like information omnivores. They were soaking up all kinds of information in all kinds of ways. The people who worry about the echo chamber worry that people are going to narrow their universes. Information becomes more voluminous, that people, just as a coping strategy, will only look at the stuff that agrees with their point of view and only deal with the people who support their ideas. But in fact, these omnivores, in particular, the most technologically adept people, are, you know, scanning every horizon they can, and they can't help but bump into stuff that doesn't agree with them.
That's a different response to information from what we've seen before. All the experts we spoke to believe that children growing up on the net will be better at some kinds of thinking and maybe worse at others. That all that time spent online has already slightly rewired their brains. They also assume that the rewiring will advance along with the technology. There's prehistoric precedent for that. Gary Small.
I would put forward that all the new technology will create a major milestone in brain evolution, just like the development of the handheld tool did many years ago.
How did that change our brains?
It coincided with the growth of the prefrontal cortex, as well as coevolution of grammatical language and more complex social networks. So that was a major milestone, just that one minor invention. So I think that the future brain will be quite an extraordinary organ, and it will seamlessly interface with our external computer technology.
Our future brain, freed from the gravitational drag of space or time or even language, will inevitably evolve. And so must the definition of what makes us human, because it's possible that someday we will carry cyberspace inside us, and we will no longer know for sure where the human ends and the machine begins. Which brings us to Ray Kurzweil.
Ray Kurzweil is a pioneer in the field of artificial intelligence.
He's an award-winning scientist and engineer, a millionaire several times over because of his invention.
He predicted far in advance that the Soviet Union would crumble, that a computer would beat a human at chess, and that a computer communications network would span the Earth. He even predicted when.
Bill Gates has called him the best in the world at predicting the future.
Transcendent Man, a new film about Kurzweil, debuted earlier this year. It ponders the dilemma he poses. We cannot simply dismiss so respected, so prescient a scientist, nor can we easily embrace his mind-boggling vision of the future. Kurzweil believes that before the century is half over, humans will merge with their technology. Our mental capacities will seem limitless compared to today, and we will not have to die. He says it's a pretty simple calculation once you factor in the rate at which technology advances.
A key issue to understand is that information technology grows exponentially, basically doubling every year. What used to fit in a building now fits in your pocket, and what fits in your pocket today will fit inside a blood cell in 25 years, and it gives you some idea of what will be feasible.
You've said that the year 2045 is the year of the singularity. Can you explain what that is?
By 2029, we'll have finished the reverse engineering of the human brain. There's already 20 regions of the brain we've modeled and simulated and tested. We'll have very powerful and very small computers by that time. Most of the computers in the world are not yet in our bodies and brains, but some of them are in our brains. If you're a Parkinson's patient, you can put a computer in your brain. It's not blood cell size today, it's pea-sized. And if you take what we can do today and realize these technologies will be a billion times more powerful per dollar in 25 years, 100,000 times smaller, you get some idea of what we'll be able to do. And one thing we'll be able to do is send millions of nanobots, blood cell-sized devices, inside our bloodstream. They'll keep us healthy from inside. They'll go inside our brains and interact with our biological neurons, just the way neural implants do today, and put our brains on the internet, make us smarter, provide full immersion virtual reality from within the nervous system. And so we will become a hybrid of biological and non-biological intelligence. So over time, the non-biological portion of our intelligence will predominate. And that's basically what we mean by the singularity. When you get out to 2045, we'll have multiplied the overall intelligence of the human machine civilization a billion-fold. And that's such a profound transformation that we call it a singularity.
You've just breezed by some extraordinary predictions that our brains and personalities someday will be basically downloadable, that we'll have full body virtual reality. How will the internet look and function? How will we interact with it when we reach the singularity?
Well, let's take some scenarios from, say, the 2030s. The nanobots in our brain would, if we want to go in virtual reality, will shut down the signals coming from our real senses. So to our brain, it feels like we're in that virtual environment. And these virtual environments will be very realistic. a counterpart to real reality. And we'll also mix up real and virtual reality. We'll have augmented real reality. So if you look at somebody in real reality, there'll be little pop-ups telling you information about that person and so on.
You know, when people write about you, there's often this tone of, I know this sounds absolutely insane, but this Kurzweil guy is really, really smart, and he's created a lot of revolutionary things, so maybe we shouldn't dismiss him out of hand.
Well, first of all, I've been making predictions for 30 years. They've tracked very well. It actually is pretty remarkable how predictable the trajectory of these information technologies is. I predicted a World Wide Web tying together hundreds of millions of people emerging starting in the mid-1990s, and I said that in the 80s, and that seemed ridiculous when the entire U.S. defense budget could only tie together a few thousand scientists with an unreliable network. But it grew exponentially, and it happened right on schedule. And we're going to get from here to the world of 2035 or 2045 one step at a time, and it's going to be thousands of little steps. And each little step will be some new product announcement, some new technology. It starts out not working that well, then it works a little better. And we get from here to there through many of these benign steps, but you put them all together and it reflects a pretty profound transformation.
Okay, let's say your predictions come true. Our brains will essentially be computers and we'll live in a virtual world. Will we cease being human?
We will be very much human. Scientists are very fond of saying, oh, there's nothing special about humans. We didn't descend from the gods. We descended from worms. And there's nothing special about the Earth. It's just a humble planet around a routine star. But there is something unique about humans, and that we're the only species that we know about that actually extends our reach with our tools ever since we picked up a stick to reach a higher branch. We're already a human machine civilization. Our tools are part of who we are. They always have been. And that's what's unique about human beings.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Enjoying it.
Ray Kurzweil is an inventor and the author of several books, including Fantastic Voyage, Live Long Enough to Live Forever, and The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, we're replaying a series of stories all about the Internet. Up next, the Internet's midlife crisis.
This year, the Internet turned 40. And that's an age when you start to feel a little vulnerable, especially if you've worked too hard, played too hard, and swallowed too many foreign substances without reading the warning labels. You could pick up a virus, a parasite, or worms. Conficker is all three. It can hop from computer to computer on its own power. It can attach itself to an innocent document. It can guess passwords and slip in through the back door. Last year, it infected roughly 12 million computers. Eventually, security teams defanged it. Then, just a few weeks ago, a new, more virulent strain appeared. The last time Conficker invaded U.S. computers, it mostly lay dormant. It didn't do anything. But there's no telling what it could do, because Conficker is a multi-stage program. First stage, infect. Second stage, act. Imagine 12 million remotely controlled computers, an enormous botnet.
A botnet is essentially taking the open internet and turning it into a supercomputer.
John Markoff covers technology for the New York Times.
In theory, at some point, they will send the programming instructions to all the computers that have been turned into zombies, that have been taken over by Conficker, and they can do whatever they want. And so what might that be? They could cause them to distribute more malware. They could cause them to send spam. They could cause them to basically send fire hoses of data at different companies or networks on the internet and shut them down. And no one knows what's planned.
The internet's creators didn't fret over apocalyptic infections. In its first 19 years, it was the playground of trusting techies and innocent geeks. Then it became available for use on college campuses and, well, You know what happens in college.
In November of 1988, a Cornell University graduate student whose name was Robert Tappan Morris launched this program into the internet, which was then composed of about 60,000 computers. And he meant to simply have a program that would travel around the then brand new network and basically do nothing.
Robert Tappan Morris, RTM, just wanted to leave his mark, a little internet graffiti. But anticipating the network's computers would rebuff his little program, he tweaked it so that it would send itself over and over again. The adolescent internet was completely overwhelmed.
Think about the Sorcerer's Apprentices, all those broomsticks running around. And it turned out to be a catastrophic programming mistake, and he brought the network to its knees.
It was the first worm. The thing is, 20 years later, the internet is still susceptible to that kind of worm. Only now, the importance of the net has grown, and along with it, so has the sophistication of the attacks and the sense of impending doom, which the Air Force in this ad says it's ready to confront.
Nuclear power is regulated through the use of computers. Your water system's regulated through computer systems. Because we operate so much in cyberspace, that is the new battlefield.
What we've seen in the course of the last 12 months is the United States government admitting publicly that both China and Russia have hacked their way into secret computer systems in the Pentagon, including the Secretary of Defense's own computer system.
Richard Clark, now author and security consultant, served as special advisor to President Bush on cybersecurity.
I think it's very plausible that a group could, for whatever motivation, achieve destruction in the real world by things that they do on the internet. The United States government has proved to its own satisfaction that you can attack the electric power grid through cyberspace.
Like the plot of the Bruce Willis film, Live Free or Die Hard.
Transportation system's crashing and they just hit the entire financial sector, everything, all of it.
Power outage keeps spreading, about half the East Coast has already gone down.
Hey, wasn't that about a pathologically frustrated former cybersecurity official who proves our vulnerability by almost destroying the country?
Yeah, unfortunately, the New York Times review of Live Free or Die Hard suggested it was modeled after me, which I didn't consider very flattering.
So then what's the solution? Is it just better software, essentially fixing the devices we use to connect to the net, or do we need a new internet?
I think we need parallel internets for a limited number of very sensitive functions. What I'm talking about is probably migrating less than 1% of internet traffic off the internet.
You know, I'm just wondering, even if the Pentagon were to develop its own very secure net, anytime it hooked up to the regular net, it would become vulnerable, would it not?
Well, that's exactly what happened 2 months ago. The people working in the Pentagon on the real unclassified internet were downloading things and putting them on their thumb drives and then moving their thumb drives over to classified computers. Well, guess what? The Russians figured that out. And the Russians came up with a virus that looked for Pentagon internet addresses and then looked for computers that had thumb drives on them and downloaded a virus onto those thumb drives. And the virus then walked across the room and got into the top secret network of the Pentagon.
So the hope of a separate network is really a false hope, right?
No, I think if you are going to have a separate network, you have to have some real discipline on it. And what the Pentagon did after the fact was went around with cement and actually cemented up the USB connections on their computers so that people couldn't use thumb drives.
Oh, give me a break. Cement? This is why many computer scientists say it's time to consider a wholesale redesign of the way data flows on the net.
The infrastructure that makes up the core of the internet, the switches, the routers, they really haven't changed since the dawn of the internet 40 years ago.
Stanford engineer Nick McEwen is part of the Clean Slate program, one of several efforts around the world to create a net that is capable of evolving.
It hasn't stayed still because it was perfect. It's really stayed still because as soon as there are billions of users using the internet, it becomes almost impractical to change.
Take those aging routers. They're kind of like the post offices that sort and deliver our data online. Routers have to be adjusted or replaced by hand. That's why it took more than a dozen years to fix a mounting problem. not enough IP addresses, the unique tags composed of digital bits that every computer online is supposed to have.
Today, it uses 32 bits. The idea is to use 128 bits. And so when you move from 32 to 128, there are so many possible addresses that there is no way we're going to run out. So, very simple idea. Took 15 years to introduce. Why was that? It was because the network itself, how did the switches and routers know to look at the 128 bits instead of 32? It's baked into all of the boxes.
All the boxes in the whole world. How much easier it would be, say the folks at Clean Slate, if we could just send instructions to the routers when the need arose.
For us, it was a collective rallying cry, a wake-up call to ourselves to say, you know, we really should be thinking a little bit more outside the box. Let's ask the question, what would we do if we had the opportunity to start over from scratch? How would we design the internet?
The new network architecture isn't going to solve our problems.
Researcher Stefan Savage teaches computer science at the University of California, San Diego. He says he likes to use an unfair analogy.
The question I like to ask people is, what are you going to do to the highway system to reduce crime? And when you put it that way, it sounds absolutely ridiculous. Because while criminals do use the highway, no rational person is suggesting that if only we could change the transportation architecture, that crime would go away. And yet, in a certain sense, that's what people who propose that a new internet architecture is going to solve our security problems are heard to be saying.
Most of the experts I spoke to said we have far less to fear from cyber terrorists than we do from online vandalism and crime, a flood of spam, a website crash, a clever ripoff. But Savage says we're fighting that battle exactly wrong. There are way more computers than computer criminals, and yet...
We tend to focus on protecting the PCs, spending about $100 billion a year on IT security. We have chosen the broadest and most expensive front to take on this fight. And I'm suggesting that, in fact, there are bottlenecks on the financial side of cybercrime that are far more vulnerable.
Savage says more cops should be following the money. And he doesn't think we should mess with the structure of our wide-open, free-and-easy, online, nobody-knows-you're-a-dog internet. Because that's what's led to everything we now enjoy. YouTube, Google, the World Wide Web itself. They happened because people willingly took candy from strangers and risked having their computers turned into zombies or bricks.
The fact that we have these rich experiences on the internet where you can have Flash come up and you can have messages from all of your different friends on Facebook and so forth is a testament to that freedom. And I just can't contemplate, I mean, it would be literally inventing everything from scratch. And I'm not sure if you could replicate a significant fraction of the experience that we have today. That one I don't see happening.
I don't believe that a practical alternative to the internet is conceivable.
Clay Shirky teaches new media at New York University and is author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations.
In part because of the installed base, but also in part because I don't think anyone would allow the engineers to do their work in peace.
Any improvements would have to pass muster with copyright holders, law enforcement, political interests. The pressure would crush any wholesale redesign of the net. But Shirky does think that adjustments are needed to cope with the fundamental problem of life online, anonymity. The internet's greatest virtue is also its greatest vice. Hippie geeks built the internet on trust. We need to address the reality that often nowadays, trust is not an option. The old neighborhood just ain't what it used to be.
How do two people who want to do business with each other come to trust each other?
The answer, says Shirky, actually comes from a professor of political science named Robert Axelrod.
And Axelrod's answer was only the shadow of the future, right? I won't rook you in a transaction today because you and I might do business again tomorrow. And so successful regimes create the shadow of the future, and then they can actually set up cooperating networks even inside incredibly hostile environments. We start having digital signatures in one way or another that says essentially, I trust you directly because we've done some business together, or I trust you because people I know trust you, or I don't trust you. No one I know trusts you. And then I'm either going to not do business with you or I'll do business with you at arm's length.
So how would we know when it's safe to take candy from a stranger? What would a good housekeeping seal of approval look like online?
It could look like a dashboard on your machine.
Jonathan Zittrain is co-founder of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society and author of The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It.
Before you run some new code, the dashboard would have a needle that simply indicates whether experts or not tend to run the code. And then I can piggyback on the decisions of the nerds about what they run and what they don't.
Right now, Zittrain sees a worrisome trend. People handing over responsibility for their online security to outside vendors with cool new toys. It's happening now. Take the iPhone. It's a lot like a computer, except outsiders can't write programs for it unless they submit them to Apple first. Only Apple decides if it can go on the phone. The upside? A more secure device.
The downside is it sets up a new gatekeeper that's going to have its own motives and incentives that are not always the same as the consumers it's supposed to serve.
Example, somebody submitted an iPhone application to Apple called Freedom Time. Basically, it was a countdown clock for the Bush administration, and it had the tagline, "Till the end of an error." The author couldn't understand why it was rejected.
Steve Jobs wrote him back when he complained and said, "This is an application that will offend roughly half of our users. What's the point?" And my strong belief is that so much of the code we now think of as central and crucial and cool and revolutionary is code for which, when most rational people first see it, their reaction is, what's the point? You could say that about something like Twitter. Somebody says, now people can update their status with 140 characters or fewer. And the obvious reaction to that is, what's the point? Or with blogs or with Wikipedia, now at last, everybody can edit a page simultaneously. I'm sure it'll produce a reliable encyclopedia. You know, the right answer to that is you guys are on drugs. And it's only when somebody can just try it out and doesn't have to persuade anyone else that this is something for which there's a point that you get this kind of innovation taking place.
Say we want to stay in charge of our own security and get in on that innovation. How? Zittrain has an idea involving what he calls red and green zones on our computer's hard drive. A safe zone for our most important documents, bank records, health records, the novel we're writing, that would be blocked off from internet invaders. And then another zone where we play at our own risk. One thing he's sure of, we have to figure this out and offer ways to work and play online with confidence. Because if we don't,
most people will naturally migrate away from the personal computer as we know it and into architectures that are much more like gated communities with the security outsourced to a vendor. And that would be an unfortunate state of affairs. You'd end up with just the nerds back in their own playpen, happily doing cool things, but not able to share it with the rest of us.
So once there was this thing that was too good to be true, and then the whole world got in on it, and then it wasn't true. It's a sticky wicket, adapting the erstwhile nerd's playground to the realities of a nasty world. People used to call the internet the information superhighway. But to me, it's more like a beating heart, pumping oxygen to every nook and cranny. Protect it, replace the valves, and close up the leaky pipes. But block its arteries and it will die. And with it, not just future Wikipedias and Skypes, but all that may come from unbounded interconnection, ad hoc communities, colliding imaginations, the terrible and glorious potential of minds unfettered by time and distance. All of that lives and dies by the net.
you want to hear more about some of the ideas you just heard, go to onthemedia.org, where you'll find practically unedited interviews with Jonathan Zittrain, Clay Shirky, John Markoff, and Richard Clark.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Sarah Fidelibus and Kasia Gladke, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And I'm actually still on book leave, but I'll be back soon, I promise.
Please, please, please. And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.